So thanks to the organizers for the impossible task of trying to explain everything about friction. I want to also thank the people who supported the work and the collaborators, particularly Lars Pastewka, now at Freiburg, Tristan Sharp at Penn, and Joe Monti, a current student. And basically, when we try to understand friction, it's common to break it up into two parts of the problem. The first is figuring out where things are close enough to touch, which is a complicated problem that I talked about last week, and I'll just try to touch on at the end. And the other is to try to understand the contacting regions, what the actual shear stress is. So this is going to be the focus of what I'm going to talk today, how we actually get a frictional force. And I'll talk a little bit about this at the end, and there's a talk online from last week. Okay, so I think we're all misled into thinking of friction as simple because it's taught to us when we're poor freshmen at a point where we're vulnerable and believe everything. And what we're taught is that there's a force needed to initiate sliding, the static friction, one to maintain sliding. Oftentimes, we're told that the kinetic friction doesn't depend on velocity. It always does a little bit. And then going back to Amundsen's, who first published the fact that the frictional forces, both of these, are proportional to the load pushing the surfaces together and independent of the apparent contact area that we would measure with a ruler on the surface. And we're taught these in part because it comes at a point in the course where there's no other problem you can do. You don't have any other physics, so this is a nice simplification. And in fact, there's an amusing fact is that Amundsen's couldn't get reproducible results with clean surfaces, so all his surfaces were coated with pork fat, so it's a universal law for pork fat. And in many cases, we know that there's little guys like this that's on a vertical wall, and he has friction even though there's zero or negative load, right? So obviously, this you can think of other examples like tape where this doesn't work. Your shoes and race car tires have force proportional to the apparent, apparent not real area. And there's all sorts of violations of these laws at the nanometer scale. And it's sort of amusing to recount the story of some recent experiments attempting to reproduce Da Vinci's work, because they went to his notes, they built an exact replica of what he had done, and they very carefully treated wooden sliding blocks, climate controlled for over a year, and they measured the coefficient of friction. And Da Vinci had reported 0.25, and they got 0.72. And they kept doing everything they could think of, and nothing they could do reproduced Da Vinci's result. And the obvious conclusion was Da Vinci had committed scientific fraud and never done the experiment. And that's what they were inclined to believe until they took this to a K-12 outreach activity, and every student got what Da Vinci got. So the answer, again, is it's pork fat. It's the finger grease of these students that gave this answer. But this shows just how dangerous a topic friction can be. You can get a factor of three change with something that you may not know that you're contributing to the interface. Okay? So that's what makes our job quite complicated. Now, since about the mid-1900s, the common view has been that friction is proportional to load only because the real area of contact, that is where this is likened to placing the Himalayas on the Alps, which always makes Europeans nervous. And so you would get contact where the mountain peaks hit, and that would be a small fraction of the total area of contact. And in a variety of cases that I'll touch on at the end and I talked about last week, you get the real area of contact proportional to the load. And it seems natural to assume that there'll be a constant shear stress within the contact. And if one makes that assumption, then you get a friction, which is real area times this constant, this is proportional to load, so you get friction proportional to load. And it also can explain why, when you have adhesion, you might have area even though there's no load. So the gecko could be understood for soft materials like race car tires. You might squish out and have a real be equal to a naught and get force proportional to real area. And there's a variety of cases where, for example, you take a sphere, a hard sphere, and a polymer, where Hertz theory predicts a sphere on flat would have an area that grows like the load to the 2/3 power, and you measure friction that goes like the 2/3 power. So this can explain a wide range of experiments, but there's a big assumption in here, that is that there's this constant shear stress. Where does that come from? The oldest idea of where you got a local interlocking of the surfaces goes back to a number of distinguished gentlemen who assumed that surfaces were rough and they magically meshed together as shown here, and then the force needed to make one surface slide over the other is the force to lift up a ramp, and you can assign that to your freshman physics students, and they find the coefficient, the lateral force is the normal force times tangent of theta, that is the slope of the surface, which is a number between 0 and infinity and therefore explains all possible experimental data. So you're good, right? The problem, and in fact there's some very nice work by Bellador looking at cannonballs, and he was looking at the angle that you need to pull cannonballs up to go over their neighbors, and you find the coefficient of friction should be 1/3. And in fact, for this may be relevant for colloidal suspensions and things, if you have things densely packed and they're monodispersed, then to slide over each other you need some dilation and you can get a coefficient of 1/3. And there were very, very robust fights about whether the coefficient of friction was always exactly 1/4 or 1/3 for a period of time, because people believed there should be nice round numbers, and this was part of the debate. So this is a nice story. What's wrong with it? Well, first of all, surfaces like this are unlikely to match. When I take two arbitrary surfaces, they're unlikely to fit together in this way. And there's lots of examples where we roughen surfaces, make the slopes steeper, and we actually get lower friction. Hard disks used to use that. The finger grease that I told you about doesn't affect the roughness, but changes the coefficient of friction. And also, it doesn't explain kinetic friction, because once I get up over this peak, the force goes in the opposite direction. So you can show the average force is identically zero. You get zero kinetic friction, and yet we find often that kinetic and static friction are similar. Okay, so this doesn't work, but it shows us part of what's hard about friction. Somehow, whenever we put surfaces together like this, they find a local free energy minimum, and we have to put on a friction force to lift them out of that, in that minimum. They're somehow always finding a state that makes them happy. And the kinetic friction, which is related to energy dissipation as you slide, that's not obviously going to depend upon the same things, but typically is in fact related to the static friction. Okay, so I'm going to do some simulations, show you some simulation results now, where we're trying to see how surfaces can lock together. And so we're going to look at an elastic substrate, and we're going to try to calculate the elastic response as we push a sphere or a disk onto that surface. And what makes this difficult is that the elastic interactions are long range, so if I have a lateral dimension of order L, the depth that I need to describe the elastic interactions is also proportional to L. I have a 1 over R Coulomb type interaction. And so this can be a L to the fourth problem for big systems. But by replacing the substrate with quasi-harmonic approximation to the exact Hamiltonian, we can turn this into a linear problem that we can solve with the Green's function technique. And we can work with systems with micrometer dimensions, keeping atomic scale information, and do it on a GPU in a reasonable amount of time. So we want to look at some scale effects. And so why is it difficult to understand why we get friction in the contact? Well, let's imagine this very special case shown here, where we have identical crystal surfaces, same spacing, same orientation. And what you see here on the bottom is the local force, which changes in sign from plus to minus. This is just that meshed surface moving over exactly as I discussed. So the average force is zero, okay? And if I ask what is for different atomic interactions, what is the local force law, it turns out that if I have purely repulsive interactions, I just get the Coulomb result that the force is proportional to load. I'm sort of moving up the hard sphere walls. And if I go to the case of adhesion, say I imagine that these are two pieces of gold that are interacting with the same potential, then I get something that's basically the yield stress of the solid, and I get a constant stress in and a force proportional to area. So simple local laws give us either of those two results. Okay. So that's this very special case of alignment, but of course that will be rare. Even if I have two pieces of gold or graphite, there will likely be at some angle relative to each other. And then I get a sort of moiré pattern where the atoms are either on top or in between each other in different places. And now the force is opposed to being coherent and being the same for the entire surface has patches. So there's lines that move this way as we slide that way. And the average force, the average of the red and blue, is effectively zero. There's almost no force acting on this surface as it slides. And it was around 1990 where Hirano and Shinjo pointed out that unless there was a common period, you shouldn't have friction between surfaces. And therefore, we should have super lubricity. There should never be friction anywhere. That was news to people who studied friction. They were a little skeptical. But in fact, there's a variety of experiments that show that they're right in the very special case where you have incommensurate surfaces. So here's krypton on gold. And Jackie Krim found the force to slide had no static friction. It was viscous. It was proportional to the velocity. And in fact, the time, which goes inversely with the friction, grows as you go from a liquid layer to a crystal. That is, a crystal slides like a fluid with lower viscosity. And we can understand that because the crystal adapts less to the substrate, stores less energy, and dissipates less energy. And these are the experimental results and simulations showing you can understand how this changes. And then there's been a lot of more recent work. This is some nice work. This has got to be shown at least four or five times in every tribology congress, this particular thing. Graphite, when aligned, you get high friction. And when it's misaligned, you get low friction. And then there's work pushing little islands around on a surface by Dietzel and co-workers, where they find the yield stress goes like 1 over the square root of the area. That's what you'd expect if you just add a bunch of random numbers. The force would be proportional to the number of atoms to the 1/2 power. Okay, so you get a force proportional to the square root of area. Here's force versus particle area. This is a square root. If it's incommensurate, like a crystal, you get more perfect cancellation. And you get something that grows roughly as the 1/4 power of the area. I think they put a third there, but I think the consensus now is 1/4. But it's a small change. Okay, so we should almost never get friction at large sizes. Now, it turns out that when they do this in ultra-high vacuum, they get what I just told you, everything changes in air, and I'll get back to that towards the end. So we wanted to look at how things have changed if we included elasticity. So we're going to do a calculations where we're going to take a disk which has the period of the substrate, but which is at some arbitrary angle, and we're going to include the elasticity of the substrate. And it turns out there's an important length scale. Let's suppose that I want to have this part of the interface stay stuck, and I want to take this part and slide it by a lattice constant relative to the other piece. So I'm going to have some deformation at the interface where part slides and part doesn't slide, okay? So that creates a dislocation. There's sort of a missing atom. And that dislocation tries to relax, and it turns out there's a characteristic length scale, the core size of a dislocation, that's the lattice constant times the shear modulus of the substrate divided by this stress. The bigger the stress is, the narrower the core size, the stiffer the system, the bigger the core size. So this is the minimum length scale over which half of this could be stuck and the other half could move by a lattice constant. And there's no reason to move less than a lattice constant because that's sort of the period of the potential. Okay? So it turns out if we look at something which is small compared to that size, it does just what we saw before. All the atoms move up and down together, and we get the same friction that we would have expected. On the other hand, if we have something which is big, in this case 126 times bigger than the core size, we get dislocations nucleating at the edge of the interface and moving in. Why do they nucleate at the edge? It turns out continuum mechanics gives you a stress singularity just like that at a crack tip at the edge of a contact, 1 over square root singularity. And so that's where the stress is biggest, and that's where things nucleate. And experiments with elastomers show the same sort of dislocation moving in. And again, it moves in from the side, not the front or the back, because the energy of that dislocation is lower. So what we find, if we look at the frictional force averaged over the entire system, divided by the value that we would have just locally for an individual atom that was aligned, when we have a small system, so this is A, the radius of our disk divided by this core size, when that is less than 1, everybody moves together and we have this constant microscopic stress. As we go to larger size, we see a power law decrease with a power law related to the stress singularity. And then at some point, we trap a forest of dislocations inside the interface, and now the stress needed to move turns out to be the Pyle stress for moving dislocations, okay? Now, we can do the same thing for the incommensurate case, and we find, again, for small contacts, you get this cancellation of forces, and the friction force drops as a power law, going to zero in the infinite size. But if we have a large contact, we get saturation, and we get saturation at some value, which turns out to be the same as for the commensurate. So this is aligned commensurate zero angle. These are a bunch of incommensurate cases. I'm plotting the friction in the large size limit, where we expect the Pyle stress. This is an independently calculated Pyle stress for a single edge dislocation in the system, which is predicted to go exponentially with the core size over d, which is the same as g over tau max. And what do we see? We see everybody falls on the same line. In other words, it doesn't matter. Once things are big, dislocations dominate and patches can move independently. And much to my surprise, when we did the same thing with a system that was disordered, you can make arguments using Imbri-Ma-type arguments, which again say there should be an exponential decay with the stiffness. And this shows as we increase the size, we get a saturation. Moreover, These are results for commensurate crystals, incommensurate crystals, and a disordered amorphous material, and they all show the same behavior, which to me was rather surprising. Okay. And this shows experiments, which again, for an amorphous solid, show a stress that's decreasing with contact area and then saturating, much as we've seen in our simulations. Okay? So, what I've just told you so far is that it's really unlikely that things will interlock, but if one includes elastic metastability, the fact that parts of the contact can advance independently, one gets a remarkably robust friction strength. It's just exponentially weak in the ratio of the stiffness to the interfacial interaction, which is an unfortunate result of being in the marginal dimension for this effect. So this is probably not going to explain the average friction that we see. We need some other way of the surfaces adapting to each other other than elasticity. One way that can happen is by welding or intermixing, and this is most likely to happen, say, for metals in ultra-high vacuum, where it certainly has been observed. You've all written with a pencil, I assume, and maybe some of you have done machining. In those cases, you're clearly removing material. This tends to be true for high loads and sharp tips. You get wear that uses up energy and gives you friction. And what I'm going to try to argue is maybe more relevant for this group is that in many cases, the material between surfaces can start acting like a glass. Let me just show you very quickly some examples of this. So this is, these are simulations of metal welding. This is a simulation of a polymer weld, where as you shear the polymer, the chains eventually break, and you can get interdiffusion by a very small distance, giving you more or less bulk strength. And Jay Feinberg has some evidence that this kind of thing may happen under pressure in PMMA contacts. And there's some work that shows, obviously, you can get covalent bonding in ultra-high vacuum that gives you high friction. And there's some old work that's been done on sort of machining that shows you get no friction until you start doing damage, and then one can see friction from this sort of wear. This is rather dramatic, and what one sees in many cases when one has molecules like the finger grease of those students or the pork fat of Amundsen is that you can have surfaces which may not map, which may not have the same period, but stuff that's put in between, adsorbed molecules, can go and find places where there's room, where its free energy locally is minimized. And then once all these guys have minimized their energy, any motion of the bounding solids increases the energy and is resisted by a shear stress. This shear stress looks like a generic shear stress for a glassy material, which tends to have a constant value, which would be, say, the yield stress at zero pressure, which is related to adhesion, and then a pressure-dependent term. And if you take the real area of contact and you multiply by something of this form, it's not constant, as often assumed. It's got a constant term times the real area, but then the real area times pressures, the normal load, so you get a friction coefficient that has a term proportional to real area and another proportional to load. And as you can imagine, you can fit even more things with such a law than you can with either independently. And Coulomb used this form to fit some of the experimental data. So this is nothing new. But if you look at, say, bulk glassy material, it turns out, say, for polymer glasses, generically, alpha is about 0.1. And it's related to how much you need to dilate Palmer glasses to slide molecules over each other. So this gives you a very simple way of understanding how you might get a fairly constant coefficient of friction just from the geometry argument again of moving over ramps. And this particular result is very insensitive to the exact geometry because it's a glass, it has many ways of locking together. So just to show you, if I take such a system and I have sphere on flat and I have bare surfaces, I get friction that's not proportional to load, but I put in some glassy molecules and I get a nice robust friction proportional to load. And there's been a lot of work here in Jacob Israelchevili's lab showing that fluids, one can find to small spacing, act like solids. So here is the force as a function of distance. You see these oscillations. These are related to the fact that in very small spacings, you see layering of the fluids. This grayscale gives you the density of atoms between some tips. And this layering gives you peaks in the force to squish layers out and then followed by decreases. So a wide variety of simulations and experiments show that when layers get thin enough, in this case, 5 molecular layers of this molecule, you get friction proportional to load. Here, down to 2 layers, you get more friction. So that's an example with friction proportional to load, but there's other cases, as shown for OMCTS, which I think we'll hear more about, and Octane, where once you have 1 or 2 layers of molecules, you have a fairly constant force per unit area that's of the same order of magnitude as you would expect for the yield stress of a glass made from that same material. This is some results for monolayers, again showing a fairly constant shear stress. And perhaps the most interesting for this conference, here's the friction force as a function of load in water. It's a 0.5 molar KCl solution. The actual separation between the mica surfaces is only 1 or 2 molecular diameters. And in this case, you see a force proportional to load, not area. This is a case where the high, where the surfaces are seeing purely repulsive forces on the approach. So you expect maybe the force proportional to the load, as opposed to having a constant shear stress. So generically, in cases like these, where there's repulsive interactions, they tend to see force proportional to area. So probably this is the mechanism most likely to operate in many of the things that we've heard about at this meeting. And I'm running out of time. I just want to briefly talk about the part I haven't discussed, which is what happens when you look at rough surface contact. It turns out that in many cases, if we have, say, rough spheres, we will get an area of real contact proportional to the load. That implies a constant pressure in the contact. And what a lot of work over the last decade or so has shown is the characteristic pressure in these contacts is given by the elastic modulus, Young's modulus over 1 minus mu squared, times the RMS slope, which is why I asked for the slope to be measured, and 0.1 was reported yesterday for a rough surface. And this number turns out numerically to be about 2. So there's a characteristic pressure related to the modulus that determines how much area touches. If you add adhesion, there's the binding energy per unit area divided by the range of interactions that you have to take into account. And if you have a sphere, you can calculate the characteristic pressure predicted by the Hertz contact mechanics theory, which is this. And what contact looks like depends upon the relative size of these pressures. And this, for example, shows The area normalized by the Hertz prediction is a function of the normal load over 12 orders of magnitude in load, showing that you cross over from something with area proportional to load, and we heard about experiments that I guess Daniel will tell us later in the week, where you see this linear regime initially followed by a crossover to Hertz. So this is rather easy to do. If people send me a surface, I can do the calculation. Lars Pastevka has a website where you can upload it. And this, I think, is rather well understood at this point. We have a pretty good theory for the area of contact. Knowing the area's proportional load is not enough to give you Amundsen's laws, because it's really hard to understand why you get a robust shear stress within the contact. The best way I know is this example of a glassy system, and I'm out of time. Thank you.
Do I stay at home from OIST to help rich people for questions?
So why is it that Da Vinci got a smaller coefficient? Because you're mentioning Greece. From your glass explanation, you could have thought that it would increase the coefficient.
Yes, yes, you could. to be honest, I don't know. I mean, I guess the it really depends upon the molecules, and what we've seen is it depends to some degree on how well the molecules fit within the roughness on the surface and other things. So a longer molecule will tend to reduce friction and give you less glassy behavior. Something like squalane doesn't lock as well. It's a good as some short hydrocarbons that seem to pack well. So so there's really a lot of devil in the details of exactly what those numbers are for the individual, for the particular chemistry.
Can you, you must have thought about why the friction force is proportional to the area. Can you go a little bit beyond?
Well, so, I mean, it's not, I don't think it's always proportional to the area. I mean, I think that probably something like this, okay, which gives you a term proportional to the area and a term proportional to the load, that I think I've seen quite generically in many things. And so what is this? Well, tau naught then, it represents, if I have some glassy system, I have some interface, it represents the shear stress of that interface. But in many cases, that shear stress grows as I push the surfaces together harder, right? Now, if I have the contact mechanics case that I showed here, okay, then within the contact, I have a relatively constant pressure. So that alpha P term would then have a constant value associated with this, just because area is proportional to load, okay? And so you can imagine that even when you have that tau naught plus alpha P pressure-dependent shear stress, you get something that looks constant because the pressure in the contact is constant. Of course, you wouldn't expect this to be a material quantity because it has the RMS slope of the surface in there, which presumably is not a material parameter.
Heinrich Heger, just following up on that, so there's a length scale in there somewhere where you must compare your roughness or the gradient of the roughness with something else about the surface, right? Maybe the size of the particle or something else, right? So explain again what that would mean experimentally and whether that means that certain particles behave different from others then.
Okay. So it turns out that if you look at area proportional to load, that means there's a constant pressure, area, load over area, okay? There's a pressure. There's an elastic modulus that has the same units as pressure. So the surface can only enter in terms of the slope. Okay? So, so there's nothing else that enters the problem, and there's a lot of numerical results that confirm this. And the simplest way of thinking about that is if I want to flatten a surface, if this is the slope, then the strain I need to impose is basically given by the slope, okay? So that's the simple story. Now, when you start to include effects like adhesion, which has a characteristic length scale, then the roughness scale, whether there's roughness on the scale of the length scale of adhesion, might be important. In most cases, though, this is an atomic scale, so it's a very small length scale, so it doesn't enter. When you start talking about spheres, then you get another length scale, the radius of the sphere. And what we've found is that that when the Hertz prediction for the pressure is bigger than this, you can ignore the roughness. That basically it's flattening everything out within the contact. And that's what's summarized by this. And so generically we find that there's a region where the first bump on the sphere hits. Then there's a region where you have a sort of statistical ensemble of bumps, where you get area proportional to load, and then finally it's all flattened out and it doesn't matter. And there's a variety, you know, the three pressures that I've written here determine which regime you're in. Micrometer scale particles are in fact sort of interesting. I guess that's a 30 nanometer scale, and then here we're going up to 30 micrometer scale. So this is probably of order a micrometer. And so you might find that you don't get much of area proportional to load in some of the actual spheres that people are working with. And as I said, I'd love to have people send me surface profiles and we can do the calculation and figure out what should happen in any given case.
Oh, in your beginning of your simulation, you put a very thin layer of materials on the top surface. And because of a lattice mismatch, you see a Mori pattern, particularly when you rotate the thin layer at 1 degree of angle. Okay, then you slide the materials. You see a shear stress pattern consisting of negative shear stress strip and a positive one, right? So my question is, how the stress periodicity is related to the Mori pattern lattice parameter?
So, if you rotate, I mean, this is just a standard result. If you take two crystals, you rotate them by an angle, you get a characteristic spacing, characteristic period that scales like 1 over the angle of rotation, at least initially. Okay. I haven't talked too much. I mean, what in particular are you worried about this? I mean, the key thing is as long as this length scale is small compared to the contact size, you get good cancellation in the absence of elasticity. But once I can deform the substrate and have it lock preferentially into not sample this evenly, but create dislocation so it's sampling it unevenly, then I can get a finite friction force.
So Mark, in everything you said, the friction force doesn't depend on the direction at which you're pushing, right?
Yeah. So in this case, the dependence for a square lattice in the commensurate case, you can get some angular variation in the direction.
Pushing versus pulling back.
Oh, you mean forwards and backwards? Yes. So in the, you don't get any asymmetry in this case. Now, it turns out if you have a glassy system, right, and you shear it in this direction, you can get some memory effects where the glass knows that it was sheared this way, and now if you reverse direction, you get a lower shear stress initially. And we've done simulations. There's a lot of work that Israel Chavili's group has done changing the direction that shows that there's some memory. So you get, say, stick slip motion with sharp spikes while you continue sliding. If you stop and wait for a while or reverse direction, it takes a while to recover those because of the internal degrees of freedom. So I guess, in part, you need these internal degrees of freedom to get friction for things to lock together. It's hard with elasticity, it's easy with glasses, but then everything you see in a glassy system with memory shows up in these thin films.
Just a question, unless I missed it, you didn't tell us about any rate dependence of this, is that correct? Do you have information about that, or maybe oscillating as well?
Yeah, so in this, the case where I have the most about the rate dependence is in the glass, okay? And it turns out, I don't know if I have, okay. So it turns out that if you look at this particular system, you find that there's a log velocity dependence. And this is attributed to thermal activation. The slower you go, the more time you have for thermal activation over barrier, and therefore the lower the friction. And this is seen quite frequently for wood, for granite, for all different materials. One of the things that's odd is that you have a meter squared granite block and you see what appears to be activation with a prefactor of the log that's temperature dependent. That's hard to understand if what's being activated is the granite block, but if you have junk between the surfaces and all you have to do is thermally activate the molecules, then it's easier to see how you can get that kind of behavior. I don't know whether Jay will talk about it, but there's a whole other set of things. That's straight rate dependence. There's also state dependence that's related to how long you've sat in equilibrium, how long you've been sliding. So there's a whole rich set of things, some of which can be understood from glasses. We know glasses, as they age, increase the yield stress, and so you can understand some of the increase in static friction with waiting time and materials based on that, if there's a glassy layer.
Okay. Further questions? Peter?
Very naive question. So
those are the dangerous
when
ones.
We teach friction, we say that it, you know, even with sliding friction that's not velocity dependent, that it's generating heat and is dissipative in that sense. How do you see that in your simulations, and how do we understand that at this microscale?
Okay, the glass actually is very nice in this regard, because what happens is you end up getting a static friction that's very and kinetic friction that are close together. So basically at any instant in time, almost all the molecules are trapped in local metastable states. As you move, there will be one that becomes unstable, maybe thermally activated, and it pops, and then it dissipates almost all the energy.
Rather than putting the work back into the surface.
Yeah, and the reason is everybody else is still sort of stuck, and so everyone else is sort of keeping the framework fixed. And so this atom jumping over sort of is rattling around and has no way to transfer the energy. If you have a commensurate crystal, the way I showed, where everyone's going up and down together, then you can recover a lot of the energy, and so you get a very low kinetic friction. But in the glass, generically, you find a kinetic friction that's got this log rate dependence and is slightly below the static friction, and almost all the energies being dissipated. It's much the same thing if you look just at the yield stress of a glass. You get the yield stress and you get the flow stress, and they're very similar because very little energy is being put back into the center of mass motion because it's so disordered.
Thank you.